I'd rather underpromise and overdeliver. And I think that a lot of people get very nervous and intense when talking to high net worth individuals, and they just want to shine. And I'm in love.
Welcome to the Easemakers podcast, presented by Nines, for people who are passionate about the art of private service. Every estate manager has a story, and this is where you get to hear them. On this show, you'll learn from the best in the business, get tips and inspiration to fuel your career, and connect with people who get it. Subscribe now and join the conversation at easemakers.com. I'm Kristen Twyford, and on the show today, Muhammad Elsmore and I are talking with Sarah Korpela about navigating uncomfortable conversations with principals, relating to the families you work with, and building strong relationships with high net worth clients.
Sarah is the president of Luxury Estate Managers of Aspen, which offers estate management and concierge services in Aspen, Colorado, and Scottsdale, Arizona. Over the last 15 years, she's had a lot of practice working with new clients and building strong relationships from the beginning. But she never planned on having a career in private service.
It was a complete accident that I got into property management. I went to USC, I studied international relations, graduated in the early 90s, started working for a title insurance company. I came out to Aspen on vacation and fell in love with a snowboard instructor who ended up being my husband and father of my twins. And moved out here, had no job, nothing I was doing previously translated in Aspen. Started working at a hotel called the Little Nell as a concierge. Nobody really cared about what resume you had in this town. It was who you know, not what you know. And met a lot of the most prestigious and most successful real estate brokers in town at the time. So after a few years, one of them came up to me and said, I have a real estate company called Joshua & Company, but there's a property management component. You know, would you come on board? Do you want to get your real estate license? Would you work in property management and run the company? My partner wants to leave and I need somebody to take over. So I took a leap of faith and went to work for Joshua in the property management division. He and his partner ended up breaking up after that. And I was 6 months in property management when Steve Elliott left and I took over, and I had not one clue what I was doing, not a single clue. And I went to Chinese food with Joshua and said, yeah, I don't know what I'm doing. And he said, well, let's give it a try. And there's not at that time. And I still think to this day, there wasn't a female owned and run property management company. So he said, let's break the mold and see what happens. And, you know, best case scenario, it's a huge success. And worst case scenario, we adapt and make some changes. So that is how I got into property management, which here is, I think when you talk about property management in the industry, it's got a different connotation. When I talk to people outside Colorado, like in California, they say, well, you can't be a property manager. You don't have your real estate license. And it's different there. I'm not renting homes. I am not managing leases or holding cash for security deposits. I am literally doing estate management and managing other people's second homes for them, third homes, fourth homes, and taking care of all of the minutiae from the gutters to the boilers to the housekeeping to party planning to shopping, cars, anything that, you know, if it's legal, we do it.
Amazing. Well, we're going to get into all of that, but we're going to start with our lightning round of fun questions. So to start out, what's your estate management superpower?
Knowing when to say no to a client that wants to come on board. Knowing when it's not going to be a good fit and politely excusing myself from the room.
Great answer.
Yeah, it saved me a lot of headaches and probably some lawsuits.
Yeah.
What kind of project gets you excited?
What kind of project gets me excited? Something that has a timeline that has measurable goals, so I know when it's gotten accomplished. Something that is communicated properly. So, for example, we have a client who he owns the last, I don't want to say living, but I guess I'll say living copy of the Constitution. Yeah. I see Kristen's eyes. Yes, that's, we don't even want to know how much he paid for that, but he paid a lot for it. And he would like to have it in his home in Aspen. So our goal was to take a room, make sure it was sealed off, get the humidification perfect in that room only. I mean, yes, he wants the humidification perfect in all rooms, but this room was particularly important because of the Constitution. And we had a certain amount of time to do it in because he was bringing it out with his art dealer, and we had to have the room perfectly humidified and measured at all times. So at 2 a.m, if the humidification drops, we get a call and it has to be looked at. So something that is outside the box, but within our wheelhouse, you know, it's those two things. That's a little outside the box and it's a little terrifying, but it's within our wheelhouse of what we do. And it's a measurable component where we can say, okay, we've got this amount of time. How do we start this? What pieces are we putting in place? And how do we get it accomplished in the time frame that we can get it done? And then the other ones are, that one is, you know, very technical. And then, you know, we get clients that want to have reindeers and Santa and Mrs. Claus for their 2-year-old Christmas birthday party. So getting live reindeer and those kinds of things are fun too.
That sounds like elves. Quite the task.
My kids would definitely appreciate that.
Yeah, call me. I'll handle it.
You manage homes in Aspen and in Scottsdale. What's one difference that you have noticed between the two places?
I think it's, you do have a lot of wealth in Scottsdale, but it is a different type of wealth. You have older money in Aspen, newer money in Scottsdale, and they spend differently. So you have to understand who you're marketing to. I think one time you and I discussed before, I don't do a lot of advertising and I don't do any social media for the Aspen business. In Scottsdale, we tend to do that. It's a younger crowd. It's a more technologically advanced and interested crowd, and faster moving, faster paced. So it's a completely different animal in what they want for their houses and what's important to them and how they want to be communicated with. That's been my biggest hurdle, I think, is learning how to communicate effectively, not only marketing wise, but once you get the client in Scottsdale versus in Aspen.
What's the best tip you got from a coworker or a principal early on in your time in private service?
When things are going well, run the table. And I remember thinking, don't, you know, I'm pretty type A and OCD, and I've hopefully managed it in my personal life, but in my professional life, it does suit me. And I can overthink things a great degree. And I had somebody that I worked for that's very successful. And he said, you know, you have to take more risks and you have to try, you know, you have to think outside the box a little bit more. Otherwise, yes, you will always have a successful business, but it will always just be this one component. And he said, things are going well. So when things are going well, run the table, take that gamble, put all the poker chips on black, do whatever it takes that isn't going to risk everything, but you've got to risk something. Otherwise you're never going to grow from where you are. And he also said, scared money don't make money. So if you've got the money to do something, you know, if you're being scared about your money, you're never going to make money. So those are the two. Scared money don't make money is probably my favorite.
Two great quotes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Great lightning round all around. And you've really hinted at a lot of the different parts of our conversation today. So I want to go ahead and get into that. So today we're going to talk a lot about how to relate to the families you work with, how to communicate with them, how to have uncomfortable conversations with them. So to start out, take us to the very beginning of a client relationship. How do you kind of get to know them and learn their habits and preferences and frustrations from the very beginning?
Absolutely. I think it comes naturally, just being a curious person and being intuitive of people and how they act and respond and how they answer the question. I do think that it comes more naturally to me than it does to some of the people on my team. And I watch it because I do try to set my team up to be able to do what I do, because I'm not going to be around forever and everybody needs to start advancing in that direction. I've done it for so long and I can ask the right questions and glean the information, and not just what is said, but what isn't said, and decide how to direct that conversation for that individual so they are comfortable sharing with me. They don't feel like there's any pressure. They can open up and give me all of the information I need to be able to say, yes, I can make this work for you. This is going to be a great experience. And I think I can take what you've had and change it for you. Or, you know what? I politely decline because I think that the things that you are looking for are not necessarily problems with the previous property management company. It might be a problem with your home and your expectations and your communication. So the first is an intake call or an email. I ask a lot of questions. I always say, you know, please know you don't have to share anything with me, but the more you share with me, the better I can help the situation. So I want to respect people's privacy. The people, the high net worth people we deal with are very private people. And you want to make them feel comfortable that they can trust the situation and they can trust me. So I'm always very close-lipped. I never drop names. They know that I will give examples of things, but I will keep my client's privacy impeccable. And once I've got that trust from them, then they'll open up more and then the communication starts flowing. And as soon as that communication starts flowing, you can really glean what has gone wrong for them. And I can tell them, I don't know that this went wrong because the property manager did it wrong, or this went wrong because the communication, the expectations weren't managed. Here's how I would do it. And it might not be perfect, but this is the result you're going to get. And I've gotten to the point in my career where I am incredibly honest and blunt, and I do not oversell. If anything, I undersell what we do because I'd rather underpromise and overdeliver. And I think that a lot of people get very nervous and intense when talking to high net worth individuals, and they just want to shine. They just want to put, and yes, do I want to put my best foot forward? Of course. But I also want to be reasonable. I'm not going to make promises I can't keep.
You mentioned how trust is a big piece, especially in the beginning, if you're not going to collect the information you need unless you have that trust. And I think you gave a great example of that. Don't say you're going to do something and then not do it. Don't overpromise and underdeliver. That's a great way of building trust. That might take a little bit of time, but what else do you do? Maybe could be a small detail that does get that across to the client. I'm here for your needs. I'm here to help you. You can trust me.
You know what I say? And I just said this yesterday to a client that they bought a house from one of my clients and went straight into a massive remodel. And we've been kind of just on the periphery, charging them, you know, hourly to go over and check things because they had a construction person on site. And he called me and said, we're about to move into the house. We need Dave's help to get the house owner ready for us in the next 2 weeks. We're not sure what we're going to do. We like what your program has to offer from what we know of it, but we have spoken to other companies. And after a 20-minute conversation with him, I just said, I certainly know that we could take care of you, but if it's not going to be a right fit, we both need to know that early on. And I think that the dialogue that we have together over the next 2 months while you're moving into the house is going to let us know that. And if I am not the right fit for you, I absolutely not one hard feeling whatsoever. I want to find the company that is the right fit for you. And so when somebody in that position understands that I am not clamoring or desperate for their account, and it means as much to me as it does to them to make sure that we are a correct fit for each other. And that if I'm not the right fit, I will have absolutely no problem giving them recommendations or offering them another option that I think would fit them. Because I do know almost everybody in this valley, and I do know who works well with who and what people are looking for. So once that person hears that, I think it opens up the door to an even bigger, more genuine conversation. And we end up at the end game that we both want to be in. And that might mean he's not my client. But I can also tell you that's happened to me several times. And 80% of the time I get a phone call a year later saying, you know what, we made a mistake. Would you take me back? And I said, absolutely. Because I never end it with anything other than, please go be happy. Please find what works for you. If it's not me, let's find what it is. And that I think has shifted my business greatly, because it's the perception, it's the gratitude and the lack. You know, they see that I am not desperate, like, please, I need you. Like, you are the key to my business. And that this is more about the relationship, which it is. If you get into this and you're not above and beyond anything else about the relationship with that person and that family, then it's not going to be a successful partnership.
You mentioned asking the right questions. What are they? What are some of your favorite questions to ask? And which ones really get you to the heart of, okay, I know what these people want now.
What are your top priorities in your home? What are the three most important things that you must have? Because my priorities are making sure that the roof is intact and the boilers are working and things are not going to flood and the alarm system. But that's not that person's. They don't worry about that. Usually it's housekeeping. They need to have a housekeeper that they trust that does it exactly the way they want, because everybody has very specific needs in that. So what are the top three things that are crucial to you in this relationship? What give me an example or two examples of things that have not gone well in your previous relationship with a property manager. And, you know, you don't have to give me intense details. Just let me know of one or two situations that rubbed you the wrong way. Are you leaving for lack of service and accountability, or are you leaving because of another reason? And is it the vendors? Did you not like the vendors that they brought in? So really just what are the three most important things that you want me to bring to the table that you're going to measure me on and you're going to measure my property managers on? Give me an example or two of what went wrong. And if you could sum up in a couple sentences, you know, what made you make this phone call? Why did you pick up the phone and decide to finally make this change? Because it is a massive change. So if I've lost a client, I know something went desperately wrong, because there are so many components that have to change in order for you to switch a property manager in this town. So what made you pick up the call? What made you pick up the phone to call me in this case? It had to, you know, the straw broke. And what was that straw?
And what do you find that straw is typically? Is there a pattern across these clients?
90% of the time it's communication and the person feeling like they're getting, that there's no respect. Overpromising, under-delivering, lack of respect and communication, and not taking that person's needs seriously. You get a lot of women are running these houses, regardless of if they're the net worth person or their husband is, and they have an opinion as to how things can, they want things to happen. And I would say they're usually pretty educated. These women are very educated in what they want, and a lot of people will not give them the due respect to listen to them and say, I totally understand that. I can get this done for you. Here's something else I'm worried about that I'd like you to pay attention to. And can we have a conversation about this? But absolutely, we can take care of A. Let's you and I talk about B, because this is also important. And it's typically respect and communication is what is happening. And somebody not getting something done and that communication. So we have a lot of projects that sometimes don't get accomplished, but I can promise you before that person steps on their plane or is planning their trip out here, they know exactly what has been accomplished, what has not, the timeline on what has not, and why. And so there's no surprise when they walk into their house. Even if something happens 5 minutes before touchdown, I tell my people, you email them, you text them, I just went in through the house for the last check. I am so sorry, Murphy's Law. This just occurred. Here's my plan of action. This is how it's not going to impact you. And our apologies. We just wanted to give you a heads up. Nobody likes surprises.
Yeah. How do you set expectations with clients from the beginning and educate them around, you know, here's how we're going to be in touch with you and here's how things are going to go? You know, how do you sort of establish that relationship from the beginning so that you don't have that breakdown?
I ask a lot of questions. Do you like to be communicated through email, text, phone calls? I will always follow up. I have a lot of old school clients that just, they want to be on the phone with you and they want to talk it out. Absolutely not a problem. It makes my millennial employees insane, but I get it. And the follow-up is, because you always, unfortunately, it's a cover your ass industry. The follow-up is, hey, Ron, it was great talking to you today. I understand that you do not think your roof is a problem and you are not worried about it. We are very concerned about it. We are going to allow you to not be concerned about it, but as you spoke in our conversation today, you have decided not to have your roof redone. So when the winter hits and we have 14 leaks, I will refer to this email and re-forward it to you for your review. And it just covers yourself, but he gets what he needs. We have the conversation. He feels respected. So I ask a lot of questions. Do you want email? Who do you want on the emails? Am I supposed to be copying your home office? Am I supposed to be copying your assistant? What do you want to be copied on? So I have copious lists of billing goes to these people, you know, vendor bids regarding projects go to these people. This person does not want to be talked to at all. You never speak to this person until they get in-house, and then you will have an in-person meeting. So we have these profiles that we build out that explain everything. So a property manager comes on board and they're like, okay, I know exactly what to do. And I know the clients that want to talk to me, and I know the clients that want to talk to the property managers. And it's just really establishing that from the get-go. So we know that those people are getting what they need from our team, and they're not being bombarded because they're also very busy and a lot of them don't want to be contacted.
Have you noticed that principals tend to want one type of communication versus another? Obviously, it depends on the age of the client, perhaps, whether they're on the younger end or more old school, but do they want daily, weekly? Do they not want to know anything unless there's an issue?
Yeah, that's funny. Absolutely. There are patterns. A lot of times people don't want to hear anything and they just want to get their bill at the end of the month. And if they have questions, they'll call me. And then other people want three bids and they want to be deeply involved and they want a phone call to happen. That particular client is 87 and he's run one of the largest, you know, international construction companies in the world. And he's a figurehead now, and he's a very grumpy figurehead. And he really loves to have that, like, he wants to get on the phone and he wants to sit on the phone with me and kind of talk through. And he's an incredibly intelligent man, and he's got a lot of great information and detail based on his career. And he just wants to get on the phone with me and tell me how badly he hates Aspen vendors because they charge an enormous amount and they don't get the job done. And so I know if I want to get a project done, I have to have three bids. I'll get on the phone call. I'll hear all of that, you know, and the misery, and then we'll get something approved. And that's his pattern. And I think it's interesting. I've had to train a lot of my employees because they're younger to have those personal conversations, and they're not comfortable with them. I think, you know, I've got young kids that are turning 19 this week, and they are, I force them to be better, but they still aren't. They never had to pick up the phone in a house and call another house and talk to a parent and say, hey, can I speak to the conversations that our younger generations are having are not as in they're not in person. They're over text. They are very low risk, and they don't have to get uncomfortable very often because they can hide behind a screen. So it's something that I've had to train a lot of people who work for me, because I do have a demographic of 24 to 34 years old of property managers, and they just want to shoot out a text and they don't want to get on the phone. They're like, oh my God, I've got to talk to this person, you know, or I have to meet with them in person. Like, can't we just text? So it's really just getting comfortable with that. And yes, Mo, everybody's got a pattern. And once you learn that pattern, it's kind of locked in your head and you know what to do with each client. And it's pretty seamless. I think it's pretty seamless because you just want to meet them where they are. It has no bearing on what I'm comfortable with. I have to get uncomfortable on a daily basis. And it really is just knowing what each client needs. I have another client who will call. He will call all of us, tell us each the same thing. And he just wants to talk.
Oh,
doesn't matter if, you know, we all three of us will answer because Britt and Tara and I all kind of take care of this older gentleman from Miami. And he just wants to talk to all of us and tell us the exact same thing. And okay.
How sweet.
Right? And I'm like, do it. He writes us a check every month. Who cares?
There we go.
Some people just want to feel heard.
Totally. Over and over and over.
Exactly. Yeah, I get it. I think what you just said about, you know, practicing having uncomfortable conversations is so important. And if you don't have that practice, it can be really hard to navigate uncomfortable conversations, especially with this group of clients. And, you know, whether you're managing their properties part-time or you're working every day in their house, I mean, that is it's a tough thing to navigate uncomfortable conversations in that environment.
Yes.
What is your advice for navigating those situations?
Kind honesty, and not getting wrapped up in your emotions about it. I think that we can bring the stress on because we're seeing saying no as a failure. And sometimes it is, but no doesn't have to be a failure. And when I came here and I was working at the Little Nell, it's a, you know, wonderful 5-star resort in Aspen. And the management really encouraged you to say yes anytime you can. Like, if we have to write a check because you say yes, because you need to make this client happy, then please say yes. And I really took from that and brought it to this business. And everybody knows that they are empowered to make decisions, even financial ones, that are reasonable and thoughtful in order to make a yes happen for our client. We did go through a big learning curve. I think I mentioned to you both before we were talking another time that I had a client. He was Russian oil, and he was a very complicated individual, and he had many, many requests that were something that we would not ever think to do for somebody. And that particular property manager was very yes oriented, and we probably backed ourselves into some corners that were certainly complicated and maybe could have been disastrous. One of which was, please crawl in that tree and be mountain lion bait. I promise I will shoot the mountain lion before he gets to you. Yeah. On the way to Crested Butte. And, that was one of the more tame requests that he had. So we learned a lot through that. And I was really young in my career and I wanted to make this person happy. And the billing every month was so astronomical. I was like, oh my gosh, I have to do everything he says. And I was younger and he was, you know, very intriguing and powerful and charismatic. And you're like, yes, absolutely. What can I do for you? Yes, I will do that. Yes, I will do this. And I really got to the point where, you know, 2 days in advance of them flying in, I need a vintage Rolls Royce. And I would work copious hours to find that and get it delivered in time. And only to have him roll it 2 days later because he was drunk coming home from dinner. And so you kind of go through these things and you think, okay, what's reasonable and what's expected. And so there are times that the client is going to want something, and it is not our job always to say yes. It's not our job to say no. It's our job to educate. So recently we had a client that at the last minute, we let them know in January, if you want these two projects done, which was fencing and sod, sewer work and everything in an older house, beautiful house, but older, you know, built many, many decades ago, you need to let us know by this date. They didn't. They came in and said, well, we really want it done before the primaries come in, the principals come in. And Tara, my property manager, was like, yep, we can get it done. It ended up being a massive project because when you open one of Pandora's boxes, 17 others open. So the entire team kind of had to rally around her and get it done. And what we learned from that and it got done with a sewer issue on the day before they were going to arrive. And everybody was freaking out about it. The principals wanted to come in. Everybody knew about it. They had tested the water. It came up E. coli. It was going to be cleared in 2 days, but they still wanted to come in. And everybody's like, we can't let them in. They can't come in. They can't come in. And they kept asking, like, can we do that? And so I was like, just Google it. Can they do the dishes? Okay. What kind of washing machine? What kind of dishwasher? Great. They can do the dishes. They shouldn't drink the water. And then I said, why are you all getting so freaked out about this? If they want to come into an E. coli house, all we have to do is say you're coming into an E. coli house. We bought you bottled water. We've let you know, and best of luck to you. And to really stop overreacting to other people's needs and opinions, right? And to say what she should have done, and in retrospect, she knows this, is said, I will remind you, based on the email I sent, you should have let us know by March. We cannot get this job done. If you would like this job done, we can get it done in the fall. You don't come to this kind of career unless you're a people pleaser. You don't do well in this career if you're not a people pleaser. So it's balancing out that people pleasing mode with being able to tell somebody of high net worth, you know what, this is a fabulous idea. I think you're so smart to want to do this. However, we are not going to be able to get it done in this amount of time, and here's when we can get it done. And then if they want to push forward as they did, then you start slowly and methodically sending emails. I really am a fan of paper in these cases. Like I said, if they want to have a phone call, no problem. Followed up with an email, sending these emails saying, per our discussion, you know that we are crunching time for this. You know that if this happens, then this could occur. Once we start doing the sod, the sewer line that's always been a problem may crash and become a bigger problem. Oh my gosh, guess what happened? We did the sod and the sewer line crashed. Here we are. I told you. It's kind of figuring out how to say I told you so in a really polite, non-passive aggressive way. And then coming up with another solution. Okay, here we are now. This is what we're going to do to solve the problem. Solve the problem. Okay, now here we are. We have E. coli. Here's the problem that we have now. Here's how we're going to solve it. So it's I've rarely said flat no because nobody wants to hear that. There is a creative way to get to the no where the client comes to it on their own. Our hope and goal during that project was the client would come to it on their own. They had a kind of a handler that's in between the client and us. She's pushing for it. We get it done, but we had everything backed up to say, we didn't get everything accomplished that you wanted to, but you knew that from the get-go. And we didn't have to say no. We were able to get most of it done and then parlay everything back off into the fall. So no is a hard thing to say to these clients, and they don't want to hear no. So sometimes it's just educating them on the path, what it's going to look like, and having them come to the no themselves.
What about in the example of, and I guess very similar language, something went wrong and mm-hmm. their expectations are not being met for whatever reason? How do you have mm-hmm. that conversation? How do you break that news?
We usually, I'm a fan of ripping the Band-Aid off in brutal honesty, because I think any other way you run the risk of losing the trust. And if you lose the trust, you've lost the client, right? Period. End of story. So I'd rather be brutally honest. I will always raise my hand and say, if I did something wrong or one of my teammates did something wrong, I will say we did something wrong. And we're going to come to a conclusion as to how we can fix this. We're going to come up with a plan that impacts you as little as possible. And, you know, within reason, I will look at the cost of what this was and what luxury estate managers will absorb. Because I would expect the same to be done for me in that situation. So I am never one for covering up or trying to mislead a client into believing something went wrong for a different reason. If it's a vendor and we can't control it, I will obviously say this was a vendor issue. We can't control it. This is what we're doing to fix it. If it's a timing issue and we overpromised and underdelivered on it, I will be honest about that and make amends in any way possible, either comping the labor, their management fee, taking care of the, you know, the overtime. If it's something on a weekend where we had to call in a vendor over the weekend and they're getting charged a weekend rate because we didn't manage our time well, I'll cover that. And I think just being, they respect brutal honesty, and they respect very on point communication. And as I said, you're either going to lie and lose the client, which is not my style at all. I am a terrible liar, so I wouldn't even begin to try that. Or you're going to be honest and the client's not going to forgive you and you're going to lose them anyway, but you will still have your reputation and your integrity intact. So brutal honesty, always, and as quickly as possible. You know, mm-hmm. don't let it roll down and cross your fingers that things are going to get better. Just rip the Band-Aid off and tell it like it is.
Mm-hmm. And you have hired a team to help you meet all of your clients' needs. What do you look for in your employees? And then how do you match them to the clients and help get them up to speed? I guess that's kind of three different questions, but just wanted to see like how you kind of create those matches.
How you create those matches. It's a small town. I have never put an ad in the paper for an employee. I word of mouth hire somebody that I really like that works for me. I usually say, hey, you know, please keep your feelers out and let me know if you know anybody. So it's interesting. It's awesome because everybody knows each other. I've got three guys that work for me that graduated Aspen High School back in, I don't know, they're 30. So however many years ago that is, 12 years ago. I've got Britton, who's my right-hand person. Her nephew has this wonderful girl, Tara, that he's going to get married to. She played professional volleyball. I'm a big fan of, Mo and I talked about this, I'm a big fan of college athletes, because if they can manage school and athletics and coaching to that level, they are not pansies. They're hard workers, they get the job done, and they can take a lot of criticism, and they can take a lot of pressure. So people that have grown up in this valley understand the valley. Word of mouth hire, so I kind of know what the person is like. Athletes are always good to look for. I really have never not known one of the people I have hired without somebody or more than one person referring them. So that's super helpful. One of my last hires, a bunch of the guys that work for me came in. They said, this guy Cam, he's awesome. He works for Mountain Pest, but he doesn't like Mountain Pest. He wants to get into something bigger and like the overall picture of the house, and he's awesome. Like, he is on top of it. So would I have ever found Cameron from a Mountain Pest company? I'm not in houses dealing with the guy that's dealing with the ants. And these guys are like, we're at our houses with this guy all the time. He's amazing. And I interview him and he has been amazing. So that's how I find them. Their personalities, you have to, people pleasers, Hard workers, very flexible. You know, you cannot be a myopic, I need to get this task done and then I'm going to move on to this task, because you're in the, you know, 70% complete with this task and an emergency happens or something changes and we have to pull you and send you somewhere else. So you have to be able to circle back and close the loop successfully. You have to be able to pivot quickly and be adaptable to change all the time. So those are kind of the qualities that I look for. And then personalities. Every single one of the people that is a property manager within Luxury Estate Managers has a different skill set, whether it's communication, whether it's attention to detail, whether it's systems, construction. And you just get to, like, I get to know the clients. And so once I start talking to them, it comes to me pretty easily as I'm talking to the client who the match would be. Sometimes one of the guys or the girls needs another house. You know, somebody sold a house, we don't have it anymore. They're light on houses. We just need to give them a house. So sometimes it's not as, you know, esoteric as I'm making it out to be. Sometimes it's just financial. You know, I need this person to have more hours and we need a house for them. But I will make a lot of switches. And sometimes a property manager will come to me and be like, I can't deal with this particular client anymore. Like, they are just making me crazy. Once I take that, I usually make them try for 3 more months. I'm like, the people that do this to us are our greatest lessons in life. Like, there is something about her personality that is irritating you because it's probably part of your personality. And so why don't you try to find that piece? And if you can come back in 3 months and tell me what about this particular person bothers you because you don't like that about yourself, then I will consider changing it. But if I did that all the time, you know, people would be like, I don't like so-and-so. I don't want to work for so-and-so. So it's not that I don't listen. It's not that I won't make the change, but there has to be some emotional mental growth to make the change. And usually by the time I've asked them to do that, they really do have kind of an aha moment and they go back and they're like, yeah, she's not that bad. I'm like, that's so funny. Funny how that happens. She's not that bad or he's not that bad. And so, and at the end of the day, I'm like, do you think I want to deal with every single person I am dealing with? I go, you got to put on your acting hat and just make it happen. You know, you really do just have to be the bigger person. But by the time I talk to the clients and I get to know them and their personalities, I can certainly say, oh, that particular property manager is not going to get along with that particular client. And I avoid that from the get-go. I'm not 100% successful, but I'm pretty good at matching them up.
I really like that, the ability to see somebody that maybe wrongs you the wrong way. And find a reflection of yourself, right? And somehow make that about you and improve something about
your personality. Because it always is, right? Like, you know, your kids will get older and the one that you love them equally, but the one that will just get under your skin, you'll realize it's like, oh my gosh, he's exactly like me. Yeah,
that was me.
And you're like, I've got to look deeper into this. What is going on? And so I've like translated that because I work with all these younger people and I really want them to be not just successful here, just be successful in life, just be happy and successful in life. And if I knew now at 53, if I knew that in my 20s or 30s, oh my gosh, my life would have been so much easier mentally, emotionally, spiritually. It would have been so much easier. So I don't do it to be mean. I really do it because I do love each and every one of the people I work with. And I see such greatness in each of them. I want them to grow into the best person they can be. And sometimes that is being in uncomfortable situations. You know, we have to get used to that and not avoid uncomfortable conversations, situations, and grow up through those.
Were there any good books or reading materials that you came across that help you help your staff and your employees dig deeper and find some sort of revelation?
Yeah, I think... I've always been a big reader. I've gotten into podcasts lately. Love Jay Shetty's podcast. I was just listening to something he was interviewing, I think Novak, the tennis player. And it was a really interesting kind of how you grow into your purpose and how you make that important to yourself and then share it with the world. I love podcasts. I geek out on them all the time. I send them to people in the company, you know, that I think will be of interest. Mo, you and I spoke, I love sports. And so Phil Jackson, I'm a huge fan of, read all of his books. I love the way he coaches. I love hearing about how he used to coach, you know, Pippen and Rodman and MJ and how he made that work, because you do have all of these personalities that have to work together. And I think I grew up in a generation that you treat everybody the same and you treat your kids the same and everybody, and it's not feasible. And I'm equitable within the company, but I do treat each person as an individual and I coach them and manage them differently because I don't see any other way of making it successful. So I do read a lot of coaching books. I read a lot of sports psychology books. And I think it translates to business in a lot of ways, in a great number of ways. And then, like I said, I love Jay Shetty and his podcast. And I think that that's a fun one to listen to. And I'm always sending that either to people in the company or my kids and their teammates. And you can listen to little snippets and get something from it.
Well, Sarah, this has been an amazing conversation. There have been so many good tips and takeaways. Any final words of wisdom that you would share with other private service professionals about navigating uncomfortable conversations and building strong relationships?
I think practicing it, you don't get good at something unless you do it often. And I think that if you can start doing it in your everyday life, think about how many times within a day, you have an opportunity to either have an uncomfortable conversation and make it a positive, get something positive. I'm not talking about having an uncomfortable conversation and blowing up a relationship. I'm talking about something's not working and having a really down to earth, soul level, this is what we need to talk about. This is what I know I'm bringing to the problem. This is what I see. What do you think you're bringing to the problem? If you start having those in your friendships, in your marriage, in with your children, with the person bagging your groceries, whomever it is, like if you can start having these conversations and really try to be less reactive and just respond instead of react and have those conversations, then in your business life, it becomes second nature. I don't know that it's comfortable for anybody in their business life to start out with uncomfortable conversations. It's just not. And then you avoid them and then you mask them and then you start with little white lies to cover them. And then you've just put yourself in a corner that you don't want to be in. So it doesn't start with business. I honestly think it starts with your everyday, how you show up every day for yourself and for everybody in your life. And if you can start doing that, then you're going to be able to translate that into talking to people of high net worth that are intimidating and have enormous expectations and very little grasp on the reality of how you can accomplish that expectation. First world problems. And these people are like, well, but I just want it. And so I think you start in your life. I do. I think you start in your life in everyday examples. And I just rip the Band-Aid off and be honest. They will respect you so much more by being honest and vulnerable than I went through the years of trying to have an armor around me with some of these people. And I realized I was just avoiding uncomfortable conversations. And so once I became more secure with who I am and what I bring to the table, I was able to like drop that armor and not be proactively protective of myself and just be really real and honest. And once I did that, the right people responded and those people are still my clients, and the wrong people took advantage and those people are not my clients. So it's a natural progression.
Thank you to Sarah Corpola for joining us today. Learn more about Sarah and her team at luxuryema.com.
To connect with other estate managers on a regular basis, join the conversation in the EaseMakers community.
If you enjoyed our conversation and want to hear more from experts in the private service industry, be sure to subscribe and leave us a review. Tell us about your favorite episodes and let us know what you want to learn next. The EaseMakers podcast and the EaseMakers community are presented by Nines, the first dynamic household management platform built for discerning households and the private service professionals who support them. Visit ninesliving.com to see how Nines can help you bring your house manual to life so you can live with ease.
I'm Muhammad Elzamore.
And I'm Kristen Twyford.
And we'll see you next time on the EaseMakers podcast.